Okay, here's a riddle for you. How is 45 like 7? Think about it. 45 is the number of our current president, and 7 is the number of another president to which number 45 has compared himself. Donald Trump, number 45, has compared himself to Andrew Jackson, number 7. If you guessed right, congratulations. Today, you're going to hear Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee and the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson, who's going to opine on whether that is a valid comparison or whether it's even relevant to our current situation. Along the way, he's going to tell us all about Andrew Jackson. Indeed, he's been doing so, because this is part 2 of Andrew Jackson, and it's your weekly Constitutional.
It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
This is part 2 of a 2-part series on our 7th president, Andrew Jackson. So if you missed part 1, and if you've got the chance, go back to our podcast site and start with part 1. You won't regret it. If you're listening on the radio, well, stay tuned, and I'll give you a recap. We're speaking with Dan Feller. He's a professor in the history department at the University of Tennessee. He's also the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson. So he knows what he's talking about. Dan told us in part 1 about Jackson's birth in rural South Carolina. He told us about Jackson's service as a boy, really, in the Revolutionary War, his subsequent migration to Tennessee, his reading for the bar, his judgeship, his rise in Tennessee politics, his appointment to head the Tennessee militia as it marched off to the War of 1812, his elevation to a major generalship in the United States Army, just in time to lead the successful defense of New Orleans, a major victory for American forces, which, even though it came several weeks after the peace treaty was signed, was such a resounding victory that it raised American spirits and it elevated Jackson to the first rank of American politics. We talked about Jackson's service against the Seminoles in the war in which he invaded Florida. He did give it back, but eventually it led to the cession of Florida by Spain to the United States, and then, of course, elevated Jackson further. Dan Feller picks up the story.
All this made Jackson, while very controversial, also made him, it buttressed his reputation as the great military hero that had come out of the War of 1812. He started to be talked about as a presidential candidate, and there was this free-for-all election in 1824. Monroe had served 2 terms. Mm-hmm. There was no obvious successor.
Going back to 1800, that election, you had Jefferson.
Yeah, 2 terms.
2 terms. And then you had Madison, his close friend and political partner.
Yep.
And then Monroe, who was sort of next in their little triumvirate.
He was
definitely the junior partner, and he was the younger man. But he was also a Revolutionary War hero and all the rest of it, another Virginia planter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of run out of Virginia planters.
They ran out of
Virginia founders.
They ran out of Virginia planters. Yeah. Who's next? It's going to be a member of what was called the Democratic Republican Party. That's the Jeffersonian Party.
Right, they were still in power.
Because the Federalists had, as a national party, had basically committed suicide by opposing the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to look at losers, not on the battlefield, but losers in the War of 1812, it's the Federalists and the Western Indians,
mm-hmm.
In different ways.
The Federalists you're talking about the guys from north, the Northeast, who were opposed to the war because they wanted to preserve trade.
And for a number of reasons.
Okay.
They thought the war was unnecessary, that it was...
they were right.
They may have been right, and that it was incompetently managed, which it was.
They may have been right,
Took their opposition to the point of at least flirting with treason. There was some talk among at least some of them of making a separate peace with Britain.
There was actually a convention, the Hartford Convention,
where
they talked about seceding in the Northeast.
As an ultimate threat, yeah.
Yeah.
When you... Being an opposition party, and this has been a constant in American history, being the opposition party in wartime is a
Yep.
It's
the best way to lose the next election.
Well, depending upon how, basically, you're betting your own government doesn't do well. So the Federalists had ceased. They were still strong in some states,
right.
but as a national force, they had ceased to exist after the War of 1812. So it's going to be a Democratic Republican. In some ways, the obvious heir apparent is John Quincy Adams, mm-hmm. Because he had been Secretary of State under Monroe.
I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that John Quincy Adams was the heir apparent. Now, I understand he had been prominent in politics, but his dad, John Adams, was actually one of the last, he was the last Federalist president. And John Quincy sort of represented that Northeastern elite. So you're thinking he nonetheless could have come in and won the presidency.
Yes, Quincy Adams himself had turned Republican way back when.
Right.
So he had a long Republican vita by this time.
Uh-huh. You mean Democratic Republican?
Democratic Republican,
right.
Yes.
That's very confusing. That was the party of Jefferson and Madison, and the story goes that one of them wanted to call it the Democrats, the other the Republicans, so they compromised by calling it both.
I'm not sure that story.
Oh, you're going to blow up another good story.
I'd have to check that
one. Oh, jeez. Okay. For whatever reason, they were called both.
Yeah, Quincy Adams had been, remember, Secretary of State under Monroe, so he'd been serving as the number two guy in a Democratic Republican administration.
So he'd established him as bona fides as a Jeffersonian.
Yeah, he had a long record of diplomatic appointments. He had been one of the American negotiators at Ghent who had managed to pull a draw out of the War of 1812.
Right.
He'd served as American minister in Russia. He'd served as American minister in Britain.
I think he's been described as one of the most well-prepared presidential candidates in history.
And he and the Massachusetts Federalists, the so-called High Federalists or Extreme Federalists, absolutely hated each other. Mm-hmm. So if hating Federalists is a good qualification, Adams had actually tussled with these guys more than anybody else.
Okay, so he's situated to be the next Democratic Republican.
Well, he is president. Or he isn't. I think I said that he was one heir apparent.
Right.
If you wanted to look for a Virginia successor, the Secretary of the Treasury, a guy named William Harris Crawford, was now a Georgian, but he had been born in Virginia. And his party bona fides, his veto was much cleaner than Adams's in the sense that he'd been a Jeffersonian all along, served in a number of positions. He had actually been the alternative to Monroe himself. So, you know, you could say it was his turn. Then you had some upstart candidates or new generation candidates. Henry Clay, who was Speaker of the House of Representatives. John C. Calhoun, who was Secretary of War. And then Jackson as the outsider. At first, established politicians didn't take Jackson very seriously because he had a different career background than you were supposed to have, presumably, to be president of the United States. And by the way, if we can slide a little bit into recent things that have been said about Jackson.
Sure.
You know, he was an outsider, definitely in the sense that his background was military. He had served in a number of civilian posts. As a matter of fact, he'd been Tennessee prosecutor and judge. Mm-hmm. He'd been in Congress. He had been in the United States Senate briefly for partial terms, twice. Mm-hmm. He had been governor of Florida Territory after the Spanish surrendered it. He'd been in public life. He had been a public servant almost his entire adult life, which makes him very different from, let's say, Donald Trump.
Understood. So a point of comparison that might not be very accurate.
Might not be very evident.
Okay, good.
He was an outsider in the sense that he was a military man, and diplomacy and foreign affairs were extraordinarily important for the first generation.
We were surrounded by potentially hostile and far more powerful empires and had to learn how to deal with them.
Yes, I would say that foreign affairs were more important to the United States existentially at that time than ever since. You heard, for instance, President Obama a few months ago when he was president talking about who's an existential threat and who's not today. Well, the United States was surrounded in its first generation by existential threats. So it's no surprise that every president since George Washington had a very extensive background in diplomacy. As a matter of fact, all of them except Adams had been Secretary of State at one time or another.
And now you have this rube who has no international experience except that he was invading Spanish Florida.
Right. No international experience. He'd never been out of the country.
Right.
All his predecessors had done extensive diplomatic tours in Europe before they became Secretary of State. Jackson had never been out of the country. He was not, compared to his predecessors, very well educated. Mm-hmm. He had a reputation for being a wild man. Reputation
that, I'd say deserved, but go on.
I'd say deserved, mm-hmm. yes. As an aside, I've often had to answer the question regarding the 1828 election, you know, was this really the dirtiest campaign in American history? Well, is it a dirty campaign if the things that they say about you are true? And a lot of the things that were said about Jackson was true. Uh-huh. While he had fought only one duel, he had shown at times a dangerous temper. Mm-hmm. He had shown as a military man at times a remarkable contempt, or what appeared to be contempt, for civilian authority. For instance, when he was a major general, he had challenged Winfield Scott, who was another major general, to a duel.
Oh, dear.
He had, and Scott kind of laughed him off. He had, at one point, as a major general, when the administration issued orders to a detail an officer under Jackson's command without telling Jackson about it, which was a violation of protocol, and Jackson had some right to feel slighted. You're giving orders to guys under my command, you're not telling me about it.
Right.
But his response to that was to issue official orders to everybody under his command, not to take orders from anybody above his own level. So if an order comes from the Secretary of War or the President of the United States, you're supposed to ignore it.
Oh, dear. Okay.
There's this long list of things. And by the way, the accusations about his being a bigamist, which are the ones that everybody remembers today, mm-hmm. those were way down the list.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's kind of a sideshow allegation. Jackson had been a ferocious disciplinarian as a general. He had executed some guys under his own command for desertion, for mm-hmm. falling asleep at their post, and was he technically justified in doing it? Yeah. But if you wanted to make a case that he was not merely a strong disciplinarian, but that there was something wrong with him.
Right. Bit of a brute.
The case was there to be made.
Right.
Jackson, however, proved to be surprisingly popular in the 1824 campaign. It was a helter-skelter, every man for himself campaign.
Right.
And it shaped up differently in every state. Famously, Jackson, when the smoke had cleared, had won more electoral votes, more votes in the Electoral College than anybody else, with Adams coming in second. He had also, as we often hear now, won the popular vote, but you have to put about 10 asterisks on that.
Mm-hmm.
There were six states, including New York, which was by far the largest state in the Union, where there was no popular vote.
Really? The state legislatures just chose?
State legislatures.
An interesting quirk in the Constitution, is that each state gets to choose the method of choosing its presidential electors, and they didn't always take a vote, at least not a popular vote.
In fact, in the early years, almost no state, as a matter of fact, at the beginning, no state had a popular vote. By this time, after the War of 1812, more and more states were authorizing a popular vote for president.
Mm-hmm.
People are still surprised, and I love to shock them by saying, you know, the Tennessee legislature in our state could take away your right to vote for president tomorrow. Sure. You have, in fact, no right to vote other than the one granted to you by the legislature. It's gotten to the point where we assume that the right to vote is for president.
We don't even like the Electoral College, but it's in the Constitution,
and it's not.
It's not.
So, as I said, it was a state-by-state election. It's very difficult to read the raw popular returns as a meaningful indication of public sentiment.
Right.
One of the other things is turnout varied wildly.
Mm-hmm.
Today, turnout, that is the percentage of eligible voters who actually vote, varies slightly from one state to another. The election has been nationalized enough that the turnout, let's say, in California is roughly the same as it is in Idaho, mm-hmm. even though neither state is really in play. In 1824, the turnout in some states was high. In other states, it was 10 or 15%. There were states where there was no point, even if you had a right to do it, mm-hmm. in voting for president. You had four candidates. Calhoun pulled out. You had four candidates in many states where there was a popular vote. There were not four electoral tickets. Instead, there were only two or three candidates in the race, or two candidates, and in some states this was Jackson and Adams, mm-hmm. ran a combined ticket. with the idea that if that ticket wins, then the electors who won on that ticket would cast their vote in the Electoral College for whichever guy.
I'm already confused. It was a mess, but it was ultimately Jackson gets the majority in the Electoral College.
No, so not a majority. He got a plurality.
Plurality, okay.
In the Electoral College, you need a majority. That is more than half to win.
Right.
It came out Jackson first, Adams second. Pretty close second.
I smell a rat now. What's going to happen?
Crawford third. Uh-huh. And Henry Clay fourth. Mm-hmm. And under the Constitution, and this has not changed, but it's never been invoked since then. It's never happened since then. If there's no majority in the Electoral College, then the House of Representatives picks the president with each state delegation casting one vote and picks from among the top three. So that's in the Constitution. So Henry Clay's out of the running. It's going to be Jackson, Adams, or Crawford. And then there was a lot of negotiating in preparation for the upcoming vote. And so far, Jackson was keeping his cool. His people, in fact, were negotiating on his part. The one thing, by the way, I should say, well, that statistic that Jackson won the popular vote is a factoid rather than a fact. It was true that the election had shown that Jackson had popularity in parts of the country where you wouldn't expect it. I mean, Adams carried all of New England. You knew that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Crawford took Georgia, Virginia. You knew that was going to happen. Clay took the Ohio Valley. Mm-hmm. You knew that was going to happen because that was his stronghold. But Jackson, in addition to taking his own home bailiwick, that's the Southwest, Tennessee, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, he also carried North Carolina. This is in the popular vote. He carried Pennsylvania.
Wow.
By 3-1 over all the other candidates put together. Mm-hmm. He carried New Jersey.
Wow.
He ran a close second to Henry Clay in the Ohio Valley states. I mean, clearly had national appeal. So what happened in the House of Representatives, and this story could go on forever, Henry Clay announced some days before the vote that he was going to support Adams. And so in the House of Representatives, a handful of states that had actually gone for Jackson went for Adams. There were 24 states, and Adams got the vote of 13 of those, which is a majority.
Bare majority.
On the first ballot. Mm-hmm. He then appointed Henry Clay Secretary of State, and that was when Jackson blew his stack.
Foul deal.
Bargain and corrupt. Was there ever such barefaced corruption witness? But there's a backstory to this. This election is incredibly complicated. Adams and Clay did have a private meeting, as we know from Adams's diary, while Clay was still making up his mind. And they came to a meeting of the minds on what Adams called some principles of great public importance. What it looks like is an impossible deal. I mean, it looks like, you know, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump all of a sudden announce an alliance, you know, and you say, wait a minute, this can't possibly happen. So Jackson was legitimately astounded and outraged. And he hung this charge of corrupt bargain on the Clay and Adams people. And really, that tainted the Adams administration from the very beginning.
Like his dad, he had a one-term administration. Not a very popular guy, maybe not the most effective leader.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're speaking with Dan Feller, professor at the University of Tennessee and the editor of the Papers of Andrew Jackson. We're talking about the subject of those papers, Old Hickory, that fellow who was as tough as Old Hickory in battle. After the break, we will have our constitutional quiz, then we'll come back and speak some more with Dan Feller. Stick around. Well, I'm still a little bit in awe sitting here in the Potter Studios at the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier because it's so quiet. It's almost like a holy place.
Well, it's so quiet because it's a sound booth that's been designed to keep the sound out.
But you are getting in the way of my mystical experience here,
yes,
Doug.
Yes, it is mystical.
It is mystical. It is even with all the soundproofing. Welcome. Nice to see you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, Stuart, it's great to see you again. Always wonderful to be with you and the your weekly constitutional crew?
Yeah, absolutely. We're with, and the crew is here. We've got Kendall in the sound booth, and we've got lots of people pressing their noses to the window periodically. I never have seen some. There's Raquel pressing her nose against the window. I saw Sean doing it a little bit earlier. So it's a party here. We have a contestant to join our party.
Hello.
Hello. Who are you, sir?
Dylan.
Dylan, where are you from?
Big Stone. Yeah, Virginia.
Big Stone.
Go to UVA. Wow.
Are you a student there?
Sure is. I am.
What year are you, Dylan?
Going into senior year, same.
And so do you listen to us on WETS?
Yes.
Tremendous. Big Stone Gap and UVA Wise, which is up actually in Wise, of course, just right up the road.
My nephew went to UVA Wise.
Really? I didn't know that.
He did.
Yeah.
That is a...
What do you go for?
Yeah, yeah. He was. I think he did, in the end, history and criminal justice, and now he's a mortician.
Well, then.
You plug him, he plants him.
Okay, well, Dylan, we have a question for you here. Doug's going to give it to you.
I'm going to read you a question. I'm going to give you four choices. Are you ready?
I am.
What does James Madison famously say that the end of government will be in Federalist 51? What does James Madison famously say the end of government will be in Federalist 51? Is it A, growth in the federal government? B, invasion by Canada? C, justice? Or D, taxation without representation?
So when you say the end of government,
what does James Madison famously say the end of government will be? And he says this in Federalist 51.
It's kind of a toss-up between, like, the Canadians. You know, they've always been eyeing us. Like, they're kind of, they might seem polite, but never quite trusted them.
Well, and that War of 1812 didn't work out Madison.
It's either that or D. No, would be taxation without representation. Mm. And
when you say, just to clarify, when the end of government, is that the objective of government, or is that the inevitable result of government? Is that what are we aiming for?
What does Madison famously say in Federalist 51? Is the end of government? It's the end of civil society. It ever has been and ever will be pursued until it be obtained. Or until liberty be lost in the pursuit.
Okay, so we're talking about the objective, of government. When we say end, we're talking, what's the objective of government? Now, what were the four choices again?
A, growth in the federal government. B, invasion by Canada. C, justice. Or D, taxation without representation.
Well, with that a little bit more, I think you might have talked me out of the Canadians. Probably justice.
So choice C.
Yes.
Dylan, you are correct.
Yay, absolutely.
Yay.
Well, Dylan, congratulations. Make sure then that you send us your T-shirt size and your mailing address and get on Facebook and just send us a message with that information, and we will send your T-shirt to you and a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Doug. That was really good.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with Dan Feller. He's the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson and also a professor of history at the University of Tennessee. But we're going to run out of time if we're not careful here, and we haven't even gotten to Jackson's actual presidential term. So let's just kind of skim over. So from 1824 to 1828, or actually 1825 to 1829, you actually have John Quincy Adams in office for his one term.
All of the people who were disgruntled by the result in 1825, and as Adams publicly admitted, that was a substantial majority of the people in the country, joined behind Jackson.
And they're getting ready for the 1828 election.
And in 1828, and this is when the current president has likened himself to Jackson as, you know, the outsider who wins against all the, he's kind of putting two elections together there. Mm-hmm. Jackson was the upstart outsider who did surprisingly well in 1824, but he lost in 1824.
Right.
Nobody thought he was an outsider in 1828. Okay. Jackson had the upper hand in that campaign from the very beginning. Adams knew he was likely to lose. The Adams people put up a good front, but in 1828, Jackson beat him handily and entirely predictably.
So, and the stories, of course, are legion about people coming in and tramping mud into the White House and,
yeah, and that
the giant ball of cheese or something and all the rest of that. Tell just briefly, was there any truth to all of these stories?
Well, this is the kind of stuff that makes historians talk too much.
Go ahead.
Jackson gave an inaugural address, which nobody heard, which was quite typical. By the way, Jackson was not a good public speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an open reception at the White House, which was actually not atypical. What had happened in the past at such receptions is people knew who was supposed to attend and how you were supposed to behave. In an episode that has become legendary, all these people who had thronged to Washington to see their hero, Old Hickory, inaugurated, then got the word, you know, this free punch at the White House, and they descended on the White House, and there was this madhouse scene with everybody's trampling on the furniture and climbing up on chairs, and waiters are coming out with trays of drinks, and, you know, they're getting elbowed and knocked over, and
it was a melee. Was that true?
Well, this is the point. That story, that version of what happened, comes from one eyewitness account. By a woman named Margaret Bayard Smith, who was the kind of doyenne of Washington society at the time.
Who would have a tendency to exaggerate.
Who may have completely exaggerated.
Yeah. Okay, then all of a sudden everything becomes far more colorful. And so you've exploded another myth, is what you're telling me.
Well, we don't really know.
You're questioning it.
We don't really know what happened.
Okay.
Certainly something happened. She wouldn't have made it up out of whole cloth.
Okay.
But she was prepared to see the worst. Now, one thing about the 19th century, you'd say, well, what did the newspapers say the next day about this? Mm-hmm. Newspapers didn't say anything about it.
Well, they couldn't have been that extreme then.
Well, newspapers very rarely actually reported local news. There wasn't any need to report news.
And then we really don't know what happened.
We really don't know what happened.
Okay. Well, let's talk about what Jackson actually did when he was president. Now, he came in and supposedly was going to be this great populist who was supposedly against the big banks and against the Eastern establishment and all these nasty elites from New England policies.
Well, actually, he came in with two firm policy ideas. Mm-hmm. One of them was remove or expel the remaining Indians who were east of the Mississippi to the west of the Mississippi.
Okay, so this is where he really takes on the issue of Indians and removal and all that.
Yeah. Now, Indian removal, we're going to complicate again. Mm-hmm. This had been the policy of the federal government from the beginning. President Monroe, two presidents before Jackson, had in a message to Congress announced that Indian removal is a great benefit to the Indians as well as to ourselves, and that's why we have been pursuing it all these years. So Jackson was not inventing the Indian removal policy. What he was doing it was putting it at the forefront of his agenda, which previous presidents had not. And the other thing he wanted to do was clean house in Washington. Jackson thought that the existing political establishment was stacked with his opponents and that they had misused their offices to oppose his election. So he was going to conduct a real thorough house cleaning. And
I say he was going to drain the swamp in Washington?
Yes.
Okay, so he came in on Indian removal and shaking up the establishment.
Yeah, shaking up the establishment.
Okay.
Or, as he put it, reform.
Reform.
He also called it rotation in office. Okay. This issue itself is very complicated, and I think historians have actually minimized the extent to which Jackson conducted a pretty thoroughgoing purge of the federal government at the highest levels.
Mm-hmm.
Got rid of a bunch of district attorneys, for instance. The rest of his policy, the economic aspect of it, which became absolutely central,
right,
developed over a period of years. He didn't come with this.
Okay, he didn't come up with the anti-bank and anti-debt sort of platform.
No.
He just developed this idea that he actually paid off the national debt, didn't he?
Yes, though that's another factoid.
Uh-huh.
The national debt.
I just seem to be full of them, Dan. You're going to have to correct me or you're going to have to whip me into shape.
Well, okay, well, first on the national debt thing.
Uh-huh.
This is the accurate part of it. The national debt was paid off during Jackson's administration.
Mm-hmm.
He took immense pride in that fact, not only on his own behalf, but on behalf of the United States. He attached great ideological importance to it because Jackson and everybody also at the time almost instinctively compared the United States as a Republican governmental experiment to the bad old monarchies of Europe.
And we had been in debt since before our national existence.
And so finally, we'd
succeeded.
And not only have we succeeded, not only have the Americans succeeded, but this shows that a Republican government, unlike a monarchical government, only incurs necessary expenses and then actually pays them off. The American government, being a people's government, unlike a monarchical government, does not tax its own people in order to conduct pheasant hunts
and wars.
And reckless foreign wars.
Right.
Yes.
Take that, Europe. Okay. So
take
that's,
that, Europe.
But
take
you
that
say,
monarchy.
But that's not the whole story.
Well, it's not the whole story in this sense. The Jeffersonians had wanted to pay down the debt from the time that Jefferson himself was inaugurated in 1801. They had paid most of it down at the war, and then the War of 1812, they had to borrow a whole bunch more. And so the debt was at an all-time high at the end of the War of 1812. Shortly after the War of 1812, Congress passed a law called the Sinking Fund Law, providing that the debt would be paid off at the rate of $10 million a year, or rather that $10 million at least would be devoted to debt service every year.
Okay, so they had adopted a policy decades before that just came to fruition.
Policy. By the time Jackson became president, at the rate the debt was being paid off, all you had to do was project forward and it was all going to be paid in 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
Now, it is true that because the debt had been brought down to a point where I think any economist today would say it was economically insignificant, there were then proposals in Congress to do things that would cost money. Like a national system of roads and canals, which went under the name internal improvements. And Jackson, in his first several years in office, vetoed a string of internal improvement bills on the grounds that if we embark on this system, it's going to delay paying off the debt. So Jackson did hold down expenditures that might have been made.
Okay, so he
on the other hand, the Indian removal policy wound up costing vast amounts of money.
Right. What about the national banks?
The Bank of the United States, this is the second Bank of the United States.
Right.
Opposition to the Bank of the United States, or to a Bank of the United States, had been a leading item in the Jeffersonian political creed. It was one of the things around which the Jeffersonian coalition had coalesced way back when. The initial Bank of the United States, the first one, Alexander Hamilton's baby, had been chartered way back when, 1790, 1791, 20 years. The Jeffersonian Republicans in power had allowed it to expire rather than renew its charter right before the War of 1812.
They might have been able to use that during the War of 1812.
Yeah, and they were sorry about it afterwards.
Yeah.
And after the war, James Madison, who had helped launch the original attack on the bank, sent a message to Congress and it's saying in so many words, you know, oops. We know better now. So Congress created a second bank in the United States, chartered in 1816 to run 20 years. And the Bank of the United States, what we're talking about is a chartered or incorporated entity. Unlike the Federal Reserve, it's not actually part of the federal government. The model was the Bank of England, which performed, still performs, governmental functions, but was also a private bank.
Right.
Combining those two. So the Bank of the United States, chartered in 1816, still in existence during Jackson's administration, was headquartered in Philadelphia. It had a board of directors of 25 men, five of whom were to be appointed by the United States, by the president, consent of the Senate. The United States government owned one-fifth of its stock. But the rest of it was held by private stockholders. The bank made profits. It paid dividends. It had branches all over the United States. And this is a time when the only other banks in the country were chartered by state legislatures, could only operate within their own states. And most of them only, in fact, had one office. When the United States Treasury itself consisted of customs offices and land offices out in the hinterlands and a couple dozen clerks in Washington. So the Treasury itself was not a national entity. The Bank of the United States was the only financial institution of national reach.
And the only thing that we had close to a national currency were banknotes.
Were banknotes issued by the Bank of the United States,
which
under the charter were to be legal tender. The bank performed many people thought essential functions. You couldn't get along without it. On the other hand, this was a private bank performing public functions. Jackson thought that combination was dangerous. The bank pushed for a recharter early in 1832. The original charter still had 4 years to run. As part of the 1832 campaign, Jackson was running for re-election. His opponent was Henry Clay. The Clay people decided to make an issue of this. They thought Jackson wouldn't dare veto a recharter. because the bank was obviously essential. So they pushed a recharter bill through Congress, and Jackson vetoed it in 1832. This became one of the two signature documents of his presidency, and it's the place where Jackson really took a step forward in articulating a coherent economic philosophy. He said famously, "It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes," which is probably the single most famous statement Jackson made in his presidency.
A lot of people might agree with that.
A lot of people might agree with that. And his point was that while the bank might or might not be essential to do the nation's business, the one thing that was certain about it was that the original charter had been a huge boon to the stockholders, that the recharter was going to be an additional boon to the stockholders, that this was, the Bank of the United States was an instrument through which private parties were made richer by legislation drawn up to their liking and even at their dictation.
Okay, so he actually was an economic populist in that sense. He was trying to return power, financial power, to the people as opposed to the rich guys.
In that sense, he was. And he also, in this message and later in his farewell address in 1837, which followed up on it and kind of elaborated the same idea, he said, and I'm not quoting exactly, but it was to these words, "The ordinary citizen, the farmer, the laborer, the planter, the mechanic," mechanic at that time meaning what today we would call an industrial worker.
Right.
And he actually used that litany, that phrase, that listing of people. He said, they have no access to congressmen. They don't have people to write legislation for them.
It's almost campaign finance reform he's talking
about. There is, I'll throw this in, there's one politician today whose speeches are remarkably reminiscent of this.
I think I know who it is, but go ahead, tell me.
You go ahead and guess.
Bernie Sanders?
Close, but there's one even closer.
Okay.
Elizabeth Warren.
Wow, that would have been my next guess. But yeah, very, very much the same sort of argument.
So we did attack elites, and now that we're into contemporary, I'll say President Trump, by the way, quoted that line, "It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes," at the Hermitage when he visited and laid a wreath at Jackson's tomb on Jackson's 250th birthday. So the president has also been picking up this
language,
vein of rhetoric. I would say the difference is that while the president has cast himself as opposing the elites, the insiders, I have not seen that indication that he means bankers by that. He's really talking about the Washington elite and the professorial elite, the intellectual elite, the pundit elite.
Pointy-headed professors.
People like me.
Yeah, I can't stand people like you. It's just terrible.
whereas Jackson very, very specifically meant bankers and corporations. And we have to remember that at that time, there were no general incorporation laws. A corporation was still a relatively novel means of doing routine business. Corporations had existed historically for public purposes. And for that purposes, they got individual charters, acts of incorporation, through legislatures. So to have a corporation meant that you almost by definition, you had special privilege, you had special pull to get a law through the Congress or a state legislature.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm just sure you're having as good a time as I am listening to Professor Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee and the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson telling us all about that fascinating character. And now let's continue our discussion with Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee, the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson, all about Old Hickory.
We can't skip over perhaps the most constitutionally significant thing Jackson ever did, and that was involving the Indian removal cases. Could you tell us about that?
It's always complicated. And what happened was Jackson announced very early, announced it by sending a message, a so-called talk, to the Creek Indians, which he later sent to all the other Indians, in March of 1829. And he said, basically, you have two choices. You're within states. Those states are sovereign entities. You're essentially tenants at will there. You have no fundamental right to be where you are. And your choice is to accept that status, disband your tribal government, because you can't have an independent tribal government within a state government. Disband your tribal governments and continue to live on as citizens of those states, not stated in this, but as citizens to the extent those states are willing to grant you citizenship.
Right. You're going to assimilate to the extent they'll let you assimilate.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Or if you want to maintain your tribal organization, move west. And we will help you move west. We'll put you out west, out where beyond the Mississippi, where there aren't any state governments yet. And you can live there for, he literally said, as long as the grass may grow and the rivers may run. All that language that you thought came out of a 1950s Hollywood B movie.
So that one's true.
Well, your white father does not speak with forked tongue. I'm quoting Andrew Jackson.
Are you serious?
Yes.
He said that. Your white father does not speak with a forked tongue.
Yeah.
Now, see, now that was a myth. I thought you were going to explode, but it's not a myth after all.
It's not a myth.
Okay.
Right. So this was Jackson's policy, and in its essence, it was clear-cut. It was not a different policy that had been followed by previous presidents. The difference is that they had let the Indian removal issue come to them, whereas Jackson, you might say, tried to get ahead of it. Jackson was proactive on this.
Right.
So he got Congress in 1830 to pass an Indian Removal Act, which barely passed Congress. The vote in the House, if I remember correctly, was 102-97, which, by the way, was the only major piece of legislation that was passed at Jackson's particular behest during his presidency, which is interesting.
That is interesting.
Usually when you think of a strong president, see, it's a guy with a program that he gets through Congress.
This is relatively early in his
presidency.
It's
very early.
Okay.
And if you look at the rest of Jackson's program, it's the Maysville Road veto and the distribution veto and the bank veto. It's veto, veto, veto.
Right.
And the protest against being censured by the United States Senate. It's not what we think of as a legislative record. The Indian Removal Act, if you actually look at it, by the way, it's very short.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a health care bill. It's like two or three paragraphs long, one or two pages.
Mm-hmm.
And all it says is that the president shall be authorized to negotiate with Indian tribes for their removal westward and to offer them certain inducements and payments and assistance. And that's it. And for this purpose, starting appropriation of $500,000.
Okay, but he's putting some teeth into it.
What's interesting and is often left out of this story is that this law required nothing. It mandated nothing. It, in fact, authorized the president to do what presidents had been doing already without the law.
Hmm.
Its importance was mainly symbolic because what it symbolized, and everybody understood this, was that given this congressional imprimatur or this congressional explicit license, Jackson was going to compel the Eastern Indians to move west.
Okay.
And in particular, the where the confrontation developed was Georgia. And by the way, when Jackson said all these things to the Indians about how, you know, you have no right to stay where you are, the United States had signed treaties with them saying
they
had a right to stay where they
were.
So
treaties are supposed to be among the highest laws of the land.
Okay. The situation in Georgia was especially complicated. That's where the Cherokees were.
Mm-hmm.
And they had by this time been confined almost entirely to Georgia. The situation was complicated because the United States had signed treaties with the Cherokees, guaranteeing them the right to stay where they were and govern themselves without limit of time. The United States had also, way back in 1802, signed an agreement, a kind of contract with the state of Georgia, on which the United States promised Georgia to remove the Cherokees, to remove the remaining Indians.
Right.
Georgia's part of the agreement is that they would surrender what's now Alabama and Mississippi, which Georgia had claimed as part of Georgia, to the United States so that they could become federal territories and then western states. By the time of Jackson's administration, Georgia's position is you, the United States government, have had almost 30 years now to remove the Indians. You haven't done it. We're going to do it. And so the state of Georgia passed legislation dissolving and literally outlawing the Cherokee government, assuming sovereignty and jurisdiction over Indian lands, meaning we're going to govern them and we're going to consider the land that they're on to be Georgia land.
Right.
And then, in fact, that we're going to give it away to Georgians by a lottery.
Right.
And the Indians challenged this in two cases. The Cherokees challenged it. The first case was called Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, where the Cherokees were themselves the plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall ruled that the court didn't have jurisdiction.
Right.
Because the Supreme Court only has jurisdiction in certain types of cases that are granted by the Constitution. One of them is disputes between foreign nations in the United States.
We lawyers have a technical term for this, Dan. It's called punting.
Yeah, it punted.
Punted the case. Okay. So then,
but at the same time that it punted, and Marshall was very good at this, he'd done it before, he gave it out as a pretty clear opinion that the Cherokees were in the right and Georgia was in the wrong.
Right.
Okay, so then a year or two later, 1832, the second case, Worcester versus Georgia.
Right.
In this case, the plaintiff was a Christian missionary named Worcester. The state of Georgia, in order to regulate who the Indians basically would get a chance to listen to, had passed a law forbidding anyone to enter into the Cherokee domain within the state of Georgia without a license from the state. And Worcester, a Christian minister, had gone into the Cherokee country. The state of Georgia then arrested him for violating this law and convicted him, sentenced him to hard labor. And Worcester sued. The court accepted this, and the Supreme Court ruled, Marshall again delivering the opinion, that the Cherokees are a sovereign nation within which the laws of Georgia could have no force. Now, this is the point at which Jackson supposedly said, Chief Justice Marshall's made his decision, now let him enforce it. There's no contemporary record that Jackson said that.
But that's what he did.
Well, it's not even that simple.
Okay.
First, what he did say, and this is what we do with the papers of Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a letter to his good friend and in-law, John Coffey, and he said, the decision of the Supreme Court has fell stillborn. Kind of means the same thing.
Right.
But not quite, because John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it, means I'm not going to enforce it. In fact, what Jackson said was more as an observer. You know, the court has made its decision, but it's not going to have any effect, not because I'm yet going to do anything about it. The President of the United States, as you lawyers know, has no authority to just go out and enforce a Supreme Court decision. There needs to be a legal process, and you could supply the Latin terms ordering him to do something.
And you're saying there was no order to the President?
There was no order to the President. The court's order was actually to a Georgia court.
Right.
To let this guy go.
The United States was not actually technically
part of
the case.
The United States was not a party to the case. Yes.
Right. So he was sort of an observer. Could he have done something? Possibly. But he pretty much declared his intention to stand idly by and not do anything to help the Cherokee.
No, it's not quite that simple.
Oh, you keep exploding the myths. Okay, Dan, happened?
What happened was the Supreme Court issued an order to a Georgia court. Let this guy go. The Georgia court ignored it. Jackson knew they were going to ignore it. And it's true that Jackson was tacitly encouraging Georgia to ignore it. Both Jackson and the governor of Georgia were working to avoid a standoff here. And what happened is shortly afterwards, the governor, first he pardoned Worcester. The Georgia legislature rescinded the particular law under which Worcester had been charged, convicted, and imprisoned. And at that point, the case goes away. It would never came to the point where the refusal of the Georgia court was relayed in some official form back to the United States Supreme Court.
So it was never a Little Rock.
It was never a Little Rock.
Right.
And it never got to the point where the Supreme Court, finding its order being defied, could have, you know,
Where a president might feel he had to step in and defend the power of the Supreme Court.
Again, there is a legal...
Which is what happened at Little Rock, but it never got to that point here because they kept it from getting to this point.
That's right. The case itself became moot because the plaintiff, you know, he's suing for his freedom. He's free. And the law itself imprisoning him is now off the books. That left Georgia and Jackson free to work as they had already been working, kind of in tandem. Georgians are pressuring the Cherokees by taking their land literally out from under them, infiltrating the area with Georgia settlers, claiming title under Georgia. And Jackson went to work on as he already had started doing, on the leadership of the Cherokees to get them to sign a removal treaty. And he still couldn't get the elected legitimate authority of the Cherokee Nation to sign a treaty. So he cultivated a minority faction called the Treaty Party, They signed the Treaty of Nuwachota on behalf of all the Cherokees in 1835. That's the removal treaty. And the Trail of Tears followed. What we now call the Trail of Tears, by the way, it's a retrospective term.
Sure.
Not assigned till years later. But what we now call the Trail of Tears, the forced migration under military auspices in 1838, that was, by that time, Martin Van Buren was president.
We're really basically out of time, but before we leave, I have to ask you about all the modern parallels that are be drawing between our current president and between Andrew Jackson. Where does the myth begin and where is the truth?
As has probably been apparent, I don't put much stake in those parallels. There's something a little bit silly about the whole thing, actually. Mm-hmm. As a historian generally, I would say, the idea that somebody is just like somebody else.
Like reincarnation, history in predictable
repeats
cycles.
Repeats itself. No,
right.
It does not.
Right.
History does not repeat itself. We're always getting hit over the head by that Santayana quote, and I presume Santayana was a good enough philosopher that he didn't mean that. It is not true that whether you remember the past or not, that you are condemned to repeat it.
I think maybe the best reading of that quote is that if you don't learn anything from history, you'll make many of the same mistakes that people made at earlier points.
The problem is you can learn the wrong thing from history, and we don't have time to get into this. But one of, if you remember, I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War, and one of the prime justifications for the Vietnam War was we learned from World War II, we learned from Munich.
That you got to stand up.
You got to stand up to the aggressor.
Right. Yep.
You
know,
if we don't stop them in South Vietnam, they'll be fighting us in San Francisco.
So you don't think we should be trying to draw lessons directly from the 1830s and apply them to the early 21st century?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
In order to do that, you have to strip out all the context.
Right.
And historians get to be kind of a broken record saying this, but it's true. Events are complicated. And they are embedded in context, and that context is never repeated. The idea that presidents are exactly alike, and it is not only the president who has played this facile game. Unfortunately, the disrespect, the disregard for actual historical knowledge has been great on both sides, so that we've seen the president analogize himself to Andrew Jackson in a bunch of shallow and misleading and sometimes just factually false ways. And we've seen his critics do the same thing and have made historical statements that are ludicrously false.
Mm-hmm.
Not merely shallow, but just flat out, outright, factually false. New York Times, for instance, last year said that Andrew Jackson annihilated the Southeastern Indians. If you have any respect for language, we can talk about whether it was ethnic cleansing. We can talk about whether it was genocide or cultural genocide. Annihilated means annihilated. You don't use that word unless you mean it. And I think the New York Times editorial board knew very well what it means and misused it. They also, by the way, said that Jackson vetoed the Bank of the United States, a forerunner of the Federal Reserve. Mm. And if you imagine the Federal Reserve as a private, dividend-paying, stockholder-run organization run by the guys from Enron, then it's a forerunner.
Right.
So everybody, I'm sorry to say and get on my high hat here, I think the misuse of history is every bit as dangerous, maybe more so.
Daniel,
than the ignorance
are
of history.
All alike. You are just, you always insist on facts. We insist on
the complexity, and I think many historians would say, I believe this, but I'm not the first one to say it, that what you get from studying history is not the brash certitude of either a president talking off the top of his head or his critics talking off the top of their heads, but an understanding of how complicated human events can be. Does that yield you a prescription for action? No. What it does yield is a kind of chastening humility. And I would say there was one president that I can think of who imbibed that fully. And that was Abraham Lincoln.
I was thinking you were going to mention Lincoln. But I'll tell you what, if that's our standard, none of us is going to measure up.
Unfortunately, that's true. And I don't know that Lincoln got that from reading history. He got it from being a great man.
You know, there are some people you study and you lose respect for them with every page you turn, and then there are others. It's pretty much exactly the opposite. And of course, we're here at Lincoln Memorial University. So it's a good note to end that on.
It is an excellent note to end.
You are from the University of Tennessee, Dan Feller. Thank you so very much, the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. We've really enjoyed having you.
Thank you. It has been a delight.
Dan Feller, professor at the University of Tennessee and the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.